Can you say your name as well, please?
My name is James Moss. It's spelled J-A-M-E-S, period. No, I'm sorry. J-A-M-E-S-M, period, M-O-S-S.
Can you tell me where you were born and when?
I was born in Nassau, Bahamas.
So what was it like growing up there?
Pardon me?
What was it like growing up there?
Okay, but at my early age, I did not grow up in Nassau itself. Excuse me. My mother sent me at a very early age to my grandmother, about 365 miles away from Nassau, and I grew up there until I was about 12. But during that time, I experienced a whole lot of beautiful things. But one of the amazing things to me at that time was the first white man I ever saw. I was in Crooked Island. And it was amazing and so different to me. I have never seen a white man before. In those days, as you know, young people have the privilege to see white people or any kind of color people or any different kind of things nowadays, because you can look at TV and you can get on the internet and you can see things or hear things that you never dreamed that you would see, you know? In those days, there was no television, there was nothing there to show you what a white bison might look like. No more than maybe if you read a book, you see a white picture in there. But this was a white man in person, and he was, to me, it's different. It's quite different. And it's really brought my attention to aware that he was there. And I really got to really look at him on that night. He was a missionary, and he had a service that night, and I got to see him. I got to meet him and all of that, and I was kind of satisfied after, that he was not something more or less to frighten people or something.
Okay. So when did you move to Miami?
I moved to Miami in 1944.
How old were you then?
I was about 17 years old when I moved to Miami. I'm over with my father. My father was here. My mother. In Nassau, so I moved with my father, moved to a place called Redland, in which he was living. And I came to Miami. I came to 36th Street International Airport down there, and I was excited naturally. At that time, most young people like a whole lot of light, a whole lot of lighting things happening, and I saw all this lighting and what's not, and it looks like I'm going to have a wonderful time here in this place, right? And so, driving with my father, and we talking, and suddenly I notice the diminishing of lights. One here, and one way down the road. I began to, kind of think to myself. So when I got to Redland, my father pointed out the light way back and said, "There where you're going to live, son." I said, "Here I am coming from Crooked Island. Not even Nassau." My mind then reflected to Crooked Island, because of in Crooked Island there was no lights at all, no kind of lights. The only lights you saw was lamplighters at night. Very primitive, good people. And as I mentioned to some youngster just a while ago, the name of the island is Crooked Island. It has nothing to do with the character of the people. It just was the physical shape of the island. That's why they call it Crooked Island.
So what were your earliest memories in that town?
Here?
Yes.
One of my earliest memories pertaining to segregation, you're talking about, right? Was living in Redland. I wanted to go to Miami because my whole attention is on Miami now, because this is where everything happened. And as a youngster, you want to be where things are happening. And Redland was too quiet for me. I wanted to go to Miami. And in doing so, you have to take a bus. I didn't have a car, and if I had one, I couldn't drive at the time. So in getting a ticket to ride a bus, you have to go to the bus stop station, at the bus station, black people couldn't go inside to get a ticket. You had to stand on the porch and waited until the lady gets, her attention, see you. And when she comes out there, she would come out there and ask you what you want, and you'd say to him, to her rather, I'd like to have a ticket. And then she gets your money and goes in back and get the ticket and bring back to you. Okay? The next encounter I had was after getting the tickets, then you have to go to the bus driver. You get in line, the bus driver is standing and accepting ticket at the door to get it on the bus, you understand? And he would just reach over you and get all the white tickets, so to speak. I call them white tickets. The tickets that the white people had. Get all the white tickets. And after getting all the white tickets, then he would take your ticket. And mind you, you're flashing it in his eyes all the time. So that was the second encounter of segregation, real segregation that I have had.
Is that your most disturbing memory? No?
Pardon me?
Is that your most disturbing memory?
Oh, yes. I have segregation. I work for Bell Telephone Company, as I mentioned to the young folks. And mind you, let's bear in mind, segregation was a thing all around you. Every day, there was no let up, there was no maybe some, it'll go away tomorrow and everything will be all right. It was there and it was around you all the time. Everywhere you go, you got to bear in mind that segregation was there. If you go downtown, soon as if you want a drink of water, the very, very first moment you say, well, let me go get a drink of water, it's right there. If you, some stores, you go to the store and you want to buy something, and maybe you want to try it on, the very moment you think about trying on, boom, it's right there. Some store wouldn't even let you try on what you want to buy, although you're buying it. Okay, so segregation was all around me. At night you go to work, when you come back home, some police may stop you before you get home and ask you, boy, where you been? And all this kind of stuff, where are you going? All this, you know, very irritating. And I am so glad that we have more or less gotten rid of that kind of segregation, because I don't think this generation would have taken it so easily. I think it would have been a mass massacre or mass something. If it was today with some young people the way they are today, you know? So I'm glad that we were able to kind of diminish that. It still exists, I know that, some places. But somehow we were able to kind of cover it up, put a blanket on it, so to speak, try to smother it. But I experienced segregation with even the job that I was working. You know, working in the job at the Bell Telephone Company, one of the biggest business company. And Bell had a cafeteria for its employees. A big cafeteria, big like all this in here. I mean, hundreds of people could go in there at one time in our building. And I was not able to go through the line to get something to eat. What you had to do, you had to go around to the back door and ask somebody, not even the people who serve it, ask some girl or some woman or some man who is working there to get you something so you can, if you wanted to buy something. And you're buying now. This is not something for free. You're buying, but you still couldn't buy freely, so to speak, or with, you know, just go and touch things the way you want to touch. At Bell Telephone Company, I decided, a friend of mine decided, that what we would do, we'd go in the line, and let's see what happened. So we went in the line one morning to get breakfast. We set it up with the girls who were serving. They were black girls serving on the end, you know, serving the line. So we had it set up with them, that we were coming in the line, and we wanted them to serve us. So we got in the line, and when we got in the line, they served us. when he got to the cashier refused to accept the money. So what we did, we said, well, we'll be downstairs whenever you get ready for the money to come and get it. We have touched a nerve then. You could very well sit down and eat it right there. You understand what I mean? But sometimes you got to be careful how you handle things. We touched the nerve already. We have more or less larger complaint. So what we wanted to do then, that's all we wanted to do. We just wanted to make them take note of what was happening. So we didn't sit there and eat. We took it downstairs and ate, okay? We could have very well sit there, but that probably would have caused more confusion. And who knows, it might have led into something more serious. So after that, things changed. The situation changed. Let me tell you how it changed now. You know how it changed? It didn't change so that we could go and sit and then eat with everybody. It changed. They went and built. They built a new piece to the building. Okay? They built a new piece to the building that we could go and get something to eat. Thousands of dollars. You know how expensive segregation were? Thousands of dollars they went out and built this thing just so we can go get and not sit here or something already built. And a whole lot of room. So, with Bell Telephone Company, I can tell you about them. I worked for Bell Telephone Company for 37 years. I decided, and I look at the bulletin, and it says, if you want to be a switchman or fill in your application, and it's opening for this and that, and so I did that. Only to find, because I was a janitor cleaning the floors, only to find in the trash can my applications. They throw it in the trash can. That didn't even go to be considered. But it happened in 1954 after the Supreme Court decision with the Wade versus education thing. I wrote a letter to the district manager telling the district manager that I thought it was about time that I get into the mainstream of Bell Telephone Company's business. He wrote me a letter back and told me to go take a test. So I went and took the test. Now the thing that I would like to make note of here to any young people, to you, or any young people who may hear this story, is that it pays to be ready. Prepare yourself, be ready for any eventualities, okay? What I mean by that, they sent me to take a test, I took the test, and I passed the test, okay? If I did not pass the test, and the test was set up particularly to keep me out, okay? I passed the test, and I went to work for the central office. Now, the central office is where all the telephones are hooked up. They're hooked up there, everybody telephones hooked up there, and you all the different equipment and switches and what's that. We went there to do. And in doing so, as I mentioned to someone before, my salary raised per week $40 more. Per week than I was getting for 18 years that I was working there. 18 years, although they considered themselves giving me a little raise every now and then, for 18 years I was there, and this job that I have now was $40 a week more, and this job was called an entrance job. You see what I'm saying? An entrance job. We were working there, we were not even counted as an entrance, being employees as who have been entered into the company, so to speak. So I worked for Bell Telephone Company I work in the central office, I work as a frameman, I work as a switchman, and I work in the engineering department. And after working for Bell for 37 years, I retired as a long line technician.
So what do you remember about the efforts to bring civil rights to black Americans?
What have I done?
What do you remember about it?
What did I remember about efforts? I remember a whole lot. I could remember that here in Miami, we had some great civil rights movers. Father Theodore Gibson was one. Reverend Graham was another. Garth Reeve was one. And a host of M. Athlie Range was one. A whole host of people. And I could remember that they worked very hard on getting a beach for black people to enjoy themselves. At that time, you were not allowed to go on any one of the public beaches in Dade County. Not only in Dade County, in Florida, the state of Florida. You were not allowed to go. And what they did to pacify black people, they went and they did a little thing on Virginia Beach, Virginia Key, and make a little beach out of that for black people. And in order for us to get to that, we had to take a boat. There was a boat. Naturally, somebody always making money on you. Or, you know, even that evil, was because someone wanted to make some money. So we had to take a boat to Virginia Key if we wanted to go to the beach. So that's something that I could remember very, very vividly.
Okay, what do you remember about the early days of integration?
What can I remember about the early days of integration? The early days of integration, it's kind of hard to separate integration from segregation in a sense, because one came in and and the other never left. You know what I mean? We feel as though we integrate. In a sense, we are. You know, you're integrated, you can go anywhere you want to go. But even now, that evil, that segregated, discriminating evil still exists. And we still have to do things to try to alleviate, to get rid of that. And some of the things that we can do, I would ask our young people, say to our young people, to stay steady. Keep a good head. Plan for the future. Don't get yourself in trouble with the law. That is a dead, destructive thing. The very moment you go to prison, that's the end of, almost the end of you. I'm telling you. Very few people who have been to prison came out and do well. Very few. The fact is, it's designed not only to take away your freedom, but it's designed to keep you down. From what I learned, there's nothing happening in the school, in the prison, in the state of Florida that's going to educate you for any betterment when you come out. They're not doing anything of that. So what happened to you? You come out, and the first thing it is said. It is on the record that you've been to prison. And if you've been to prison, no one wants to bother with you. Therefore, how are you going to make it? How are you going to live? And young people find themselves right back in the same old thing because they're struggling out there trying to make a living, and they can't get a job. Most of them can't get a job. And why they can't get a job? No education. They can't do anything about simple things. And nothing simple nowadays. Everything is technology moving fast. There's no such thing as, long years ago, you get your pickaxe and go out there and make gobs of money. That's not so now. They have machines that will run over you in 2 seconds, what you can't do in 5 years. So technology is the thing. And we have to learn to do things. And how you do that? By going to school and study and learn and stay out of trouble.
Anything else? Yeah, did you hear Martin Luther King's speech?
Pardon me?
Did you hear Martin Luther King's speech?
Did I hear it?
Yeah,
yes.
Speech.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't in Washington. I wish I was there. But I wasn't there. And I heard the speech and I was so proud. As a matter of fact, I'm proud today. And I think all black people should be proud of Martin Luther King.
So, all right, when what did you think about when the leaders such as Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, when they got assassinated, how did you feel about that?
Okay, I felt pretty badly about the assassination. I felt real bad about Malcolm X. Malcolm X was one of those leaders who was right to the point. You know, he didn't bend one way or the other. He was right to the point of what he believed in at the time. And just shortly, in my opinion, I think it was, shortly before his assassination, he began to see that sometimes you have to take a little, you know, take it, you can't just more or less push things through all the time. Sometimes it takes a little time to study and how you're going to do it and what effect it would have and all that kind of stuff. So, in my opinion, he discovered that maybe he should kind of start thinking about some things. And shortly after that, that is when he was assassinated. I felt really bad, real badly about him because I thought he was a magnificent leader. But I felt more so bad about King because of the way he was doing his. He was so concerned about people, all people, and in such a Christian way, in such a religious way. And although he was stirring in what he, you know, what he really wanted to do, because if he didn't, if he wasn't, there would not have been the marches and the counter-sitting and the whatever that took place to cause the change. But he wanted to do that, and he didn't want to do it with violence. And I guess that's why I felt so badly about him. Yeah.
So from the 1940s, in between that time and 2002, do you think we made some major changes?
Oh yes, we made some progress, a whole lot of progress. We made some. Our people have made progress. Of course, it could be more. I think we should have made more progress. But I don't think it's because our people wasn't ready or willing to make progress. I think because there were still stumbling black blocks in a way that perhaps held us down or held us back from making more progress than we have made. But we have made progress. We continue to make progress, and I would say to young people, don't give up. Continue to press forward.
These are your hope for the future. Is that your hope for the future?
My hope for the future, I do hope that, I don't think young people will ever go through what I've been through, because I don't think they will stand for that, okay? But I do hope that the future brings a whole lot of happiness and joy to young people, more so than we have had in my age time. I know that there's some things that are happening today that may be very, very, dangerous for young. Well, it's dangerous now. We have contemporary disease like AIDS. We have this terrorist thing that may affect the lives of young people, one way or the other, either directly with violence or in a way in which they themselves will have to kind of clear it up and clean it up. But I do hope that, and I do believe that bad as it looks, our young people will overcome all those obstacles.